welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to It's an Inside Job. I appreciate you showing up for another episode. You know, if you're a regular listener, it is quite crystal clear by now that resilience shows up in different forms and different formats. And through the medium of podcasting, I have brought on different guests to speak about their stories and their skills that they've learned through experience, how to face adversity, how to build resilience. Well, my guest this week falls into that same category where experience has shaped who he is today. Well, he is also described in the media as one of Norway's most notorious gang-affiliated members. But that was 10 years ago. But since then, my guest, Mikael Ali, or as we refer to him on the show, Michael. Currently, Michael is 43 years old, and he is the former member of the infamous Young Guns gang. And he has dedicated his life to working with the Church City Mission to help young people steer clear of criminal activities. With his past experience in the Albanian Mafia in Oslo, Mikael provides a unique perspective on why young people are drawn into a life of crime, to gangs. After over a decade away from the gang life, he has now turned his focus to preventing others from following in his footsteps. The tragic loss of his friend and former leader of Young Guns, Mohammed Javid, in 2009 also further solidified his commitment to helping those at risk. This week and next week, because of an extended interview, I've spread it over two episodes. Michael will be sharing with us his journey and the challenges he's faced in his mission to make a difference. Now, I generally don't do this, but in this episode and the next, please be advised that this interview is raw and unfiltered, where we are going to be having descriptive conversations about drug and alcohol use, violence, and suicide. So if there are young kids around, I highly suggest listening to this episode at another time. Make sure those young ears are not in the room. But for now, folks, I welcome Mikael Ali to the show, and I hope you learn a lot from it. Well, Mikael Ali, thank you for joining me on It's Inside Job. I really appreciate your time. I was wondering if we could begin the conversation by you just telling our audience who you are and what you do.
Yeah, my name is Michael, as you introduced me. My English is a little bit off, so I'm sorry if some words are not coming true, but I will try my best. Well, I'm 43 years old. I have two kids. I identify myself as a father of two children, and I am currently working with youth that have, in some ways, need jobs. Have not the opportunity to like apply them themselves. They need experience first. So I have been working for a very long time now, about 10 years, in different organizations, in different free time also with the youths and with the kids who are maybe on a different path, not a good path, in like different like criminals ways and drugs and
yes.
So that's what I've been working with, and I also have a past myself in gangs. I was almost, I was a little bit over 10 years in a criminal gang in Norway. And I also have background in Norwegian forces. I served in Kosovo, NATO. So I was one of the first people to go down to Kosovo and serve there after war.
Well, thank you for that, Michael. Thanks for that introduction. And so what I'd like to do with you is to sort of jump in the time machine to rewind back Our mutual friend, Michelle, put us into contact, and he thought you would be an excellent person for this podcast to speak to resilience and tenacity and actually shifting mindset and shifting direction in life, that you took responsibility for that. And that's what you help youth with, which may have more, if we can say it, troubled backgrounds, or are, as you've articulated, on the wrong path. Maybe the wrong path, but on a path that needs to be adjusted. Perhaps we could rewind back in that time machine and talk about the, so you were gang affiliated, and maybe about that lifestyle and how that was for you.
Yeah. Like, I think we have to, like, to get the context. I feel is important. It's like I also see in the youth I work with. It often starts in the childhood, you know. Something happened there for some reason or different reasons. So my father is from Pakistan. My mother is Norwegian. And the why I mention this is because I don't look, especially Pakistani youth, look like people don't, when they see me, they don't think Pakistani, that I'm from Pakistan. But my father is from Pakistan. I'm quite light in my skin. Some people call me almost from Albanian or something like that.
Okay, okay.
But, yeah. But anyway, it all started with like the first day at school when I started. It was like, because my name, surname
or your last name?
Yes. Yeah, last name, yeah. So last name is Ali and first name is Michael. So that was a little bit like people reacted to that, especially the kids like in sixth grade, because I was starting in first grade. And already first day at school, you know, you're standing there, you're going to meet the whole, so it's a total shift in your life. And you're nervous, you're starting school, you're standing there. Already then, the first school day, the sixth graders was like, yeah, your name is Ali after name, because they caught it on. And and then they started like calling me like Paki, you know. So it was like bullying the first day already. And I didn't know what Paki meant, you know. It was like, but it was the way they said it with the body language, with the tone. So I understand quickly this was not nice meant, you know. It was not with a smile. Yeah, so that made me very uncertain, you know, because when you're a first grader and then the sixth grader is quite a different in heights. They look very scary, some of them. So it was like started right there. And this kept on for many years on the school, like bullying. And it made me very uncertain. In my home, in the private home, it was a little bit troubling because my mother and father had different conflicts. So that too, contributed to like a little bit uncertainty in my home, and the bullying at school also. So I was a kind of kid that wasn't a leader already. You know, I was like a very closed kid. I was very uncertain. I think that was quite the thing that made me very afraid, nervous, and things like that. Because the bullying was not like 3-4 days; it was many years.
It was constant.
Yeah, constant.
Because it sounds like what I'm hearing for a young child like that, there is no stability. There is uncertainty on the school front. There was the constant conflict of racism or exclusion of bullying. And then on the home front, it wasn't the stability that a young child needed. Was that what you describe
correct.
It as?
Yeah, okay. You're correct. It's nice that you like sum it up for me because of the language, you know.
So sure, no problem.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I just appreciate you talking to this, Michael. Yeah. Don't worry about the language.
And it didn't stop there, you know. It was like, how I can describe it? It's like when the evening comes and you know when you go to school next day, I had trouble sleeping, you know, I had trouble with my stomach. It was tightening up because all of this, because I didn't look forward to going to school. It was very tough. You know, I remember I was crying and sometimes, but I didn't know how to
process it.
Feelings, because nobody was there to regulate me. So it was very like the school years, early school years, the meeting with the school, I remember as very not good. And also it was also like because of the bullying and the conflicts at home, it made also the concentration in the class very difficult for me because I didn't manage to concentrate. And the homework I did home, I didn't get so quite help understanding the homework also. So I was falling behind And that made also like the teachers had a good intention. They were, but the way they did it in the teachers, they took me out of the class to help me, to give me this extra time with me trying to learn. But the way they did it, I felt was very humiliating. You know, it was like I was the only kid who was taken out of the class in front of the whole class. So when the class, when we were in the session,
yeah,
then the extra teacher comes in front of the whole class and say, Michael, you come with me in front of the whole class, you know? So I felt like stupid, you know, people were commenting, stupid kid. They were saying different words to me. And I felt like embarrassed, you know, that it made the situation more worse than it made it good. Yeah.
It added fuel to the fire. It just.
Correct. Yeah.
Because, you know, that tightened the stomach and such. I mean, those are, obviously, we know this, but I mean, it's stress, it's anxiety, it's self-doubt. And when you're constantly, like, how old are you at this time? Like 8, 9, 10?
Yeah, no, I'm like 6.
You know, a normal brain is not fully developed till you're 25 years old. So you can imagine a 6-year-old trying to process the complexity, the racism, the exclusion. For me, it's mind-boggling. But imagine that 6, 8, 10, 12, 15-year-old trying to process this and not having perhaps someone to help them through that with homework or with the feelings or with the emotions and the ruminations of the thinking.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it just got worse, you know, because we have this, what do you call it in school?
School nurse.
Yeah. School nurse, yeah. And that is a grown-up person. This was a woman, grown-up woman. And I was alone with her because everybody had to go in turn to meet her. And she take your height, she weigh you, and you read this book with these different circles because they're going to check if you're colorblind. So I was reading this book with different circles, with colors. And you're supposed to see different numbers, you know? Mm. And I was like, 23. And I pulled to the next side, 78. Mm. So I was thinking, I got this. But then she tells me, okay, so you're colorblind. So I didn't know what that even meant, that I was colorblind. But what she says next is like, it was like a hit in the face, you know? Like I was 6 years, 7 years old. And she says, so because of your colorblind, you cannot become policeman, you cannot become a fighter pilot, you cannot become a fireman. So she destroyed my complete dreams, you know, because when I was a kid, I was like fireman, policeman, fighter pilot. That was kind of things I was looking up to, you know, playing with toys.
I mean, that's a very typical thing for young boys to think about, you know, being a cop, being a fireman, being a pilot. Or
so those different like hero stereotypes, you know. Yeah. So, but she killed that dreams in like 2 seconds when she said that to me. And I was like, I was totally destroyed. And she didn't say anything more. So and she was a grown-up person in the school system. That was a grown-up, you know, and we are taught to, okay, what grown-ups say, you have to listen to, you know, when you're a kid. So I went off, I remember I went out of the office because the office was a little bit outside the schoolyard. And it was free time for the other kids. They were playing outside. And I was standing in the corner watching down on the other kids. And, man, I was crying. You know, I was trying to pull myself together. I was like, I was so hurt. And the pain, I remember the pain to this day. It was like I could not almost breathe. So already then I was regulating myself. Okay, I was like self-talking to myself. I was like, okay, get your shit together. Okay, stop crying. Okay, you have to go down to the schoolyard now, fake it to make it, you know, stuff like that. So, and I didn't say this to anybody, not even my parents, not even the teachers, because it was embarrassing. You felt stupid, you know. It was just a confirmation that I'm even more stupid. Yeah, so it was not good the school years.
And so if we fast forward to the teenage years now, when we're teenagers, we want to be similar. We don't want to be dissimilar. We don't want to be different, right? Mm-hmm. And we want to assimilate with the rest of everyone else. Mm-hmm. So what age are we at now? Are we?
Yeah, we're at the age of 12, 13.
Yeah.
And because I was falling so behind in kindergarten school already.
Mm-hmm.
No, kindergarten is not wrong, but the school, you know.
Primary school.
Primary school. Yeah, primary school. Yeah, yeah. So I was struggling already there. So imagine when I go like to the next level.
Junior high.
I'm really behind in everything, in math, in the writing, in concentration. So I already felt, okay, how is this going to work? And I'm born very late in the year. My birthday is November. So I think I think this is very important also because of some kids today, I have, when you're born in like November, December, instead of like January, February, other kids, that has a lot to say about the development in the brain, in the body. You know probably more about this than I do, but you know.
Well, you're right on the money. I mean, those children that are born earlier in the year, obviously they have 8, 9, 10 months of development. And at that age, the brain is accelerating so fast in its development. And physically too, you'll see that a lot of kids who are born in January, February tend to be the stars on different, like on football or hockey or baseball or soccer, you know, teams, because they physically, they're just a little bigger and faster. So you're completely correct.
Yeah. So that was the case with me also, because I had this not disadvantage, but it was this also. So I felt like my height, I was shorter than everybody else. I was like, the learning ability. I think that had something to do with it too. It also, it was like junior high. Then I was also taken out of classes, the same shit, you know, the same story. But I started then also, but developing, I was getting bigger in height. It was starting in the body and the mind to also be like, I'm sick of this bullying. Because it was like, I compare it. I don't know if it's a good comparison, but if you hit the dog enough, it will bite you if you hit it enough, you know, it will defend itself.
Well said.
Yeah. That's what the metaphor I use, because I felt that I was hit. I was beaten so much in the different ways. So it was starting inside of me to get, okay. Now it's getting enough, you know, So, but I was starting also then to train weight at an early age to build a body, because I was thinking, yeah, if I only get stronger, it will help me and this mindset. So, yeah. So, but different thing happened also there, you know, because my father from Pakistan, and I experienced racism through him also, because not through him, but how people treated him. Because I was an observer in different situations, because my father was also in politics in Norway.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was very engaged with his politics, and he tried to like integrate very good in the society when I think back to it. And that had his also consequences, because he was one of the first people from Pakistan to come to Norway to start working here and stuff.
And that's about the 70s, right?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, correct.
Early 70s. Okay.
Yeah, correct. So he went into politics, and he sort of broke out with the Pakistani community. He went his own way. Mm. And it was not received well amongst the Pakistani community also in Norway, because they wanted his kids to go to come and learn the Quran.
Sure.
Yeah, so they were encouraging him to do that. But he said, no, my kids will choose themselves. So he was very strong-minded, my father also. He was like, my kids will have the ability to choose themselves. So he was very stubborn. But the way I experienced racism with him was in the junior high, he disappeared for a while. Because he was working and he was gone different times, a couple days in the politics. But I would come home from school and my mother was crying. And I understood that this was about my father, because he was then missing. He was not making he didn't call back. He was away.
No.
So short story here, he was threatened over a long period of time by Nazis, racists group, who said that if you don't pay this certain amount, we will take your children, we will hurt them. So I had that shit going also experiencing that thing with my father. And also comments when I was in the store with him, people were like, some white Norwegian people were like saying different bad words to him. And I was a kid standing next to him. And I heard this, you know, and I read it, but I was afraid. I was like very scared. So, but all these things that they made me like my father come back from, he eventually came back and he told the story to the police. And yeah, this experience also had an effect on me, because it was like somebody is threatening my family also, not only me, but my family. So I was starting to build this rage inside me.
Take a six-year-old child, bully that child, use racial epithets at that child, exclude that child, make that kid feel stupid, unnecessary, unwanted, and undervalued. And then we need to ask ourselves, how does a six-year-old process such a world, such an environment? But there is no processing. As we discovered in the episode, that the human brain is not fully developed at 25. But take a 6, 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 15-year-old trying to figure out what the hell is going wrong. And so school was a place that Michael didn't feel he belonged. He felt stupid. He felt silly. He felt unconfident. And what's that going to do with anyone's concentration? Well, it's going to tank it. And then add on top of that an unstable home life. Well, what you get is a child that does not know how to make his way through the world. And he stumbles and he stumbles and he stumbles. So in part two, Michael talks about how he took back some controls, backed some certainty by hitting the gym. Because the gym is where he can control 100% the effort. And he could see the results and the outcomes of his training. He also talks about his first real job at Pizza Hut and how that gave him structure, that gave him a sense of value and worth, that allowed him to have roles and responsibilities, and where his manager, as hard as he was, gave him feedback on his performance, and that added a sense of self-confidence. And then from there, he applied to the military, and in the military, he succeeded, he flourished. So let's slip back into the stream and hear the next part of Michael's story.
The school system, I didn't feel like I was getting the feeling of mastering it. So school was a bad arena for me. I felt like a fucking failure. I felt like this area, I really hated it, you know? Mm. But I found some salvation, or maybe like in training, you know, because then I can control it myself. I could, how long I trained, how big I wanted to get. That was something I was in control of. So training already from 15 years old, weights, I was crazy. You know, I was training and I was running like Forrest Gump, you know.
Sorry. Yeah. You put that image in my head.
There's that kid again running.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, and yeah. We shift back.
Yeah.
So the control by lifting weights, by training and take caring of yourself, and you could control, and that gave you a sense of control of everything else that seemed chaos and uncertainty. That's where you found autonomy and control. And that is where you found your oasis, or your sense of peace of mind.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I was also getting a lot bigger. Mm. And that was helping. And in the height, I was also getting more taller and the big in size. So that helped me in a kind of way that people was like, okay, we don't fuck with this guy because of the size and the strength. Because I was really pushing it hard. I didn't know much about training, but I was training real hard, you know. Mm. And I had some bigger guys in the gym who was like my personal trainers, and they were taking me under their wing.
Yeah,
I didn't know at the time that they were using anabolic steroids, you know, because those guys was like fucking superheroes in the gym, and I looked up to them. And they gave me their training regimen, and I was not on steroids. But the whole thing was when I went from this, we call it, when it's a high school, you call it next? When
yeah, the next level is the high school. So when you're like 15, 16, 17.
So I started in high school, you know, and I decided afterwards to quit. I was then the age was about 17 years old.
Yeah.
I was like, now I've had it. I don't want to go to school anymore. Because this arena is not for me. I was so fed up. Yeah.
So you dropped out at 17 out of high
school. Yeah, 17 because, years old, I dropped out. Yeah.
So all this bullying, all this, the whole thing from grade, from your 6 to 17, it just built up to a point where you just said, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm out. So I started working at Pizza Hut in Norway. and I did it quite good because this was quite different. This was a different environment. I had a very tough boss who was like, he will yell at you. He will really be on your neck, but he made me tough. He made me even better because when he gave you some good feedback, you really took it to you, you know, because then you know it meant something. So he was like a mentor for me in this job. And I accelerated very good in the job. I got higher in position. And I tried, you know, I was giving a lot of responsibility and I loved it. You know, this was not school. This was going to work using my body, using my skills, because I think when you are young and in this kind of you develop, I don't know, maybe, you know, I think you can help me with this because of the fear I had, you learn to read people's different ways. I don't know. I felt like I was like more at alert in a content fight, you know? Mm-hmm. So I had to like scan people. Okay. How are they different? Or when I went home, how would my father react? Or how would my mother react? And different survival instinct. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, what it is, you become, there's something called the negativity bias that our brain looks at. And this negativity bias, you know, we're all wired with it to look for dangers and threats and hazards. But when we're constantly under some level of threat, we become hypersensitive to this particular bias, this negativity bias. Mm-hmm. So wherever we go, you know, our something called the default mode network, it's constantly looking at social signals, at body language, at mannerisms, at inflections. And that is what we're filtered. Everything gets filtered through that. If that's what, unfortunately, you as a child through to your teenage years, if constantly bombarded on the home front, in the school front, in the schoolyard, whatever, then that becomes part of your mentality, that becomes part of your mindset. And that's what we tend to filter out of our environment. Like if you bought a new blue Volvo, right? Yeah. And you wouldn't think about it. All of a sudden you'd see blue Volvos everywhere, for example, but it's the same mechanism.
Yeah.
So yes, you were just hyper-vigilant to anything that could pose a threat to your life and limb.
Yeah. That is correct. I agree. And it also made me like very good working with people, you know? I was good with customers. I was almost like a chameleon because I could adapt to different environments, because different threat situation, different situation. Because at an early stage, I learned this, how to adapt, because I knew how to survive, you know, because the bullying, okay, so how can I stop the bullying? Okay, I must in some kind of ways, because I didn't have the strength, I didn't have the fight in me to take it on to them.
Sure.
But then I found different ways to do it. Maybe also in... It wasn't the wrong way, but it wasn't maybe the correct way, but it was like a survival instinct that, okay, I will maybe try to be friends with them in a stupid way, you know, humor a lot. I laugh and it really hurts, but you know, but I used humor a lot and also the sport aspect of it. When I was starting to train, I did very good. So people wanted me on their team, you know, I went different ways.
So you started getting recognition in that sense, right?
Yeah.
And just to go back to Pizza Hut, because I think that's very interesting. I used to work with troubled youth in the inner city Chicago back in the sort of mid-90s.
Yeah.
And one of the things was really good is if they could get a job at McDonald's, for example, and Pizza Hut sounds like the same sort of thing, because it shifted the environment, because it was a structured environment. There was roles and responsibilities that were distinctly defined. Yeah. I mean, there were the constraints in which they had to work. And so that created certainty. That created a sense of autonomy or control. But also, as you were talking about, Michael, you know, your boss was a hard guy, but he gave you feedback and you took it to heart because he's well-meaning and maybe the way he did it was direct, but you know what? That's okay too. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of youth can find structure. I mean, we talk about McDonald's and the food and stuff, but the structure of those kind of like Burger King or any of these fast food joints, they're very good in the way they manage things. And what it sounds like for you, it the gym was one place that gave you stability and control, but this was also sounded like a very healthy environment for you to find structure. Is that what I understand?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. That is, yeah, for sure. And the feedback was great because now I get praise from somebody, you know. I was, people saw me, acknowledged it. They gave me good feedback. I felt like I was doing it good, you know. So I always felt like a loser for say it loud, you know. I felt like it. But in this work situation, the work environment, I had the structure, as you say, and everything like that. So that made me feel more of value. So I was working there for over a year. And in Norway at that time, it was you were all boys were called to the army when age 18. So that happened to me. I was, because you had to go. It was no choice. So I really didn't want to go because I thought it was not another arena that people were yelling at me. And but I had to go. So but I went to the session. I did some tests, and the test out of the tests you get placed different where they think you belong. And somehow I managed to get into it's called Telemark Battalion in Norway.
Okay.
So it's a little bit, it's not the special forces, but it's a little higher than the regular army.
Okay.
Yeah. And you have in this army, I didn't know at the time, but you have also opportunity. If you do it good, if you excel, you can also, they will, you can compete for contract to go to serve in different countries, in the NATO and stuff like that. So it's very high, you know, people serve there. But I didn't know this, you know, I just went with the flow. So, but in the army also, I remember the first couple of months, I hated it. You know, I didn't want to be there and I didn't want to go back. But my father said, listen, you go back there. You have no choice. So, okay, I just had to. But then something happened because I had the strength. I had the size, you know. So I was like, and I had this fire inside me from all this bullying and shit like that. So it was inside me like, because I have never talked about it, but also in the army, you have your last name on your
lapel.
Yeah, correct.
So you had Ollie stitched there on the
on
the pocket. I meant
yeah. So I met different people from different aspects of the country, you know, and also there somebody tried, you know, like Packy tried to call me, but then that was the first time I really stood up for it. We were playing soccer, and one of the guy called, "Are you fucking Packy?" And then I stopped up, and I went. I was big at the time, so I went to him, and I said, "And I, it was kind of a kind of a feeling. I saw myself from the outside, but I went automatically to him, and I said, "You call me Packy one more time, and I will fucking beat you to death." I was really like, I didn't hit him, but I was really strong, clear in my voice, and I think the eyes were very serious, you know. It was direct tone to him, and the reaction he gave was okay. I don't want to challenge you. So that was a good feeling, but unfortunately, it was like in a threatening feeling. You know, I was threatening him. In the form of violence, and that is not good. But I learned that shit. That helped. I can use my size and this fire inside me to get what I want. So it was unhealthy way,
I think that's a very, very point. You know, the way you did it, sort of threatening, I mean, there is a downside. But at the same time, let's look at the upsides of that. You know, at some point, you've been pushed, where you thought you have to push back. And sometimes the question is, what is that threshold that pushes us to defend ourselves, to speak up for ourselves? Again, it's not to condone the way you did it, but if we just look at it where you stepped up to yourself, that was the good thing part of it. So it's not so black and white. There are some large, gray, nuanced areas here. So there is the good side, and there is sort of the questionable side of it. But anyway, so you stood up for yourself, and that, what did that speak to you when you saw this guy back down, that he even thought, okay, I crossed the line here, I shouldn't have crossed?
Yeah, so that gave me a good feeling. You know, I learned that there's a lot of power in this, using my size and my voice in different ways. Like we talked about, like you said, it's that how I did it, it's questionable, but I get a result from it. And it was also a good feedback to him. You need to stop this shit now. Mm-hmm. But it was a threat, you know.
Yeah. You could be a little more diplomatic about it, but but you know what? At some point, emotions take over, and we don't filter things. It just comes out as raw and unfiltered. Yeah. But okay, so he backed down. You learned.
Yeah, he backed down, and the situation was I started accelerating in this force in army. Mm. I was getting good feedbacks. I learned a lot of things. I was good with weapon. I was good with. But it didn't come naturally. I have to train. I was using the discipline from the gym to like, okay, I have to do these repetitions. Okay, I do the repetition with the weapon. I put it aside. I put it back in. And I was doing the drills, and I was training like crazy, you know. I had like this, I was running like crazy from before, and I had good shape. And in the force, in the army, that is good qualities. When I think about it, you know, from my background, from the bullying, from this, everything I experienced from my childhood, when you go to the army in such a place and you're training to kill, they're like feeding you with this, kill, put your gun. It was the drills constantly. I don't know if that is good for a guy with my background who has not processed things, you know, had to, because they were like building this machine. But in some aspects, it was good. I felt it was because I really got to like get my shit together. And because what I didn't mention before was when I didn't perform in school, I find different other arenas, you know, with different other kids who had similar background. And so we were doing a lot of little criminal things, like burglary and shit like that in the free time. Mm-hmm. And I was not a leader. I was a follower because I didn't have that confidence. So one of the other guys who were more like outspoken, more he seemed more like certain in himself, you know.
Yeah, but more confident.
Yeah. Because we all have different roles, I think, in different groups, you know, in a friend group, we have different roles. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, I was always a shy guy, you know. So when these other guys was like, yeah, let's do this. And I was like, okay. And I knew that it was wrong to go and steal that fucking car and do things like that. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I wanted so badly to be a part of that group, to belong. Mm-hmm. So I went along with it, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. You know, when you feel disconnected, when you feel excluded from other elements in your society, you're automatically, any human being is going to be drawn to where they feel a sense of being attached to something, feeling belonged, feeling respected, feeling part of a clique, that they're, you know, a family per se.
Yeah. Yeah, because we were already then. Like calling each other brothers, you know, we were, if I didn't have money, they will pay for me in foods. And so you felt a belonging, you know, felt like a little pack, you know, and we have different roles in this pack. So I got a taste of that belonging already in my youth. But the working, when I went to PITSAT, it saved me a little bit because I was working every day. So I didn't have time to be with the friends and do all these criminal things. And also the army saved me a lot. So I got away from it a little bit. After a while, the leadership in the army, they told me, okay, Michael, we want you to sign a contract with us. We really want you to come with us to serve in if you want to enlist and work in the army. And I felt so proud, you know, when it's because many guys I thought that was going to get the contract, they didn't. And I thought, shit, I'm not going to get the contract because those guys before me who went into the office, they come out broken. And I was like, oh shit, he didn't get the contract, I'm not in hell going to get the contract. So it was this uncertainty in me also, because I was expecting failure all the time. But when I went in there, they were like praising me, you know, we want you. you're one of the guys.
So how did you feel when you first, before you walked into that office, you're thinking, oh, okay, I'm done. They're going to sink me just like that previous guy. But then you go in, you get this praise, you get this great feedback as to your abilities, your mindset, what have you. Hmm. What's going through your head at this point, Michael?
Yeah, it was, I felt a lot of, I remember like feeling in terms of the body, I felt like I was talking earlier about the when I was getting bullied, the stomach will turn.
The tightness.
But this was more a relief. This was more like sprinkles. I don't know how to say it, but it was like from the toes up to the head, feeling that like a sense of euphoria.
That's a really good word. That's a really good word to describe it.
Yeah, so and real proud, you know, like shit, I did it, you know. So it was a great accomplishment. You know, I felt so proud, and my family felt proud about me, my father especially, because me and my father didn't have much communication, you know. He was a man of few words. but when he was proud of me, he showed it, like, then he told me, like, this was a proud moment for him, you know. He take picture with me with the uniform, and I was standing there. So that was kind of his acknowledgement of me, and I felt very good about it. And so what happened, we went down, we had more training, special training for this operation, and we went down to Kosovo. I grew in Kosovo. I was like 20 years old at that time, 20 years old. And it made me, the 6 months I was there, made me appreciate when I come back to Norway, because they wanted me to sign for another 6 months, and I got high recommends to go to officer school. And but I had enough. I felt that I need a break, because those 6 months down there, where we were the first who was down there, and it was real tough. You know, we're working every day, almost no sleep. It was
What did you learn about yourself, Michael, when you were 6 months in Kosovo? I guess you were some of the first NATO troops or the first Norwegian troops there.
Yeah, first Norwegian troops. Yeah, correct. Yeah. And I was getting good feedbacks from different, we worked with international other armies. So in different operations, when we had like searching cars, patrolling, I was getting good feedback because I was doing things very after the book correctly. I remember some from Finland soldiers there, and also from the States. They were giving me good feedback, but that was good done. That was a good work. So I grew a lot of this experience. And what I really appreciated about being in Kosovo was with the kids, you know, making them feel safe, because we were walking, we were patrolling them to schools, making they were safe, and just seeing the look in the eyes, because you saw a lot of cruelty also there down there. But to make a little difference about getting that smile from that one kid, you know, giving him this maybe a chocolate or whatever you could do to get that smile from them.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it felt good, you know. And even the kids down there drew me a painting, like a drawing, and they gave it to me, you know, because we were patrolling the same area, and they come up to me and give me this. The picture was, you know, it was kids in wartime, but it was like a tank, and it was they playing and a sun, but also bombs dropping, and also it was crazy, this picture, but it meant a lot to me. They drew it, and I was drawn on the tanks like a guy with a smile, you know.
After serving his 6 months in Kosovo, the army asked him to re-up, but he decided that he had enough, and he wanted to return back to Oslo, back to the civilian life, and he had a goal. He wanted to work for the police services, and so he got a job at a maximum security psychiatric facility for the criminally insane. Those criminals so dangerous that they couldn't put them in normal correction facilities. And there he was picking up experience. He was making the contacts to head for his ultimate goal. And at this point in the story, Michael is on top of the world. He's got experience. He's got respect. He's got some financial security. He's got a future he's looking forward to. And so him and his buddies one weekend decide to head out to Stockholm, Sweden, to celebrate. There he met the girl he fell for head over heels. But as many of you may know the story, at least those in Norway, that's when life spun out. Just when everything was on the rails, everything got derailed. As you'll learn in this next part, it rekindled his rage. All the past trauma, the tribulations, the humiliations, not feeling worth, not feeling valued, it all came to a head. He looked into the abyss and he jumped headlong into it. and he free-falled. And from that point, he didn't give a damn anymore. He wanted to burn everything. He wanted to burn everyone who had ever done him wrong. And as Michael talks about, he took the destructive path. He took the destructive path all the way to oblivion. As a soldier there, and you're helping these kids, and you're getting them to school or home safely, and you get these pictures and returns, these drawings that they do. Did you ever see yourself as that child? Like, I mean, did you reflect on your own childhood when you, in that moment, as an adult there, providing safety and structure and certainty for those children, even if it was just to patrol them to school?
Of course, they were living under different situation. But what you say, it's a sense of relation with the, this is just my opinion.
Please.
My experience. Yeah. So when I saw like the body language, you know, in some of those kids, the uncertainty, the I don't know.
The stress, the fear, some level of fear.
Yeah. I could recognize some of it.
There is a relationship because, you know, like earlier in our conversation, you know, when you have a little child trying to process a complex situation, they don't have the knowledge. They don't even have the software, you know, in our heads, the wetware. Their brains haven't fully developed. And you have to think of these little kids, you know, even yourself as that six-year-old trying to make sense of what is going on. They have no frame of reference. Their context is so limited. And you just think, how is this forming and shaping this young child's mind and brain?
Yeah, because I remember as a kid, I was very afraid of death also. For some reason, I was terrified of dying. It was so bad that I went to the doctor, you know, because my father, I was talking about death all the time. I don't know why, but I was like really afraid. Well, what happens when I die? I disappear. You know, it's total blackness. But I think that was the whole sense of, you know, no regulation, parent to talk to, like they can help me through these feelings, emotions. And I also were a lot of stress, you know, in the physical also when I was a child, because all this stress caused me to have in constant fight, you know. I was neck. I was very like tight.
Yeah, your shoulders are all tight. When you're in constant fight flight mode, right? And we don't get the chance to process emotions, because what are emotions? They're just chemical messengers. But if we don't process those emotions, they keep coming back and back and back until we address them. But they show up as tight shoulders or stiff neck or lack of sleep or insomnia or headaches.
Yeah. So I had a lot of those symptoms. Yeah. And the doctors didn't know what it was. They could not. It was not like, this is what caused it. Because I didn't tell them about what was happening at home, what was happening at school, you know. And the doctors didn't ask. They were like, okay, are you a little tight up in the shoulders? It must be some medical condition, but I think it was more mental for me.
Exactly. Back in the day, they didn't link psychology with physiology. I mean, as insane as that is, I mean, you can't separate the two, right? Psychology will affect physiology and vice versa. So yeah, I can understand a kid under constant stress, how is this going to show up? It's almost a given that that's going to happen, or it'll show up in some way. So you served 6 months in Kosovo.
Yeah.
It was a good learning point. You came back to Norway, but at that point you thought, okay, I've had
I didn't want to sign a new contract, but what happened in Kosovo was the teammates in my team, they were all like thinking, okay, what are we going to do when we come back to Norway? They were starting to plan a couple of months before we were discharged. And some took a new contract, but some of the guys were like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to apply to police academy. And I felt like, shit, yeah, police academy, that would be nice. You know, even this nurse, what she told me, you know. But I had this confidence in me now. I was like, now I'm more stronger, I'm more confident. I can really do this, because I got a lot of good feedback all the time. And I thought, yeah, this is police academy, that would be the right move, okay. But then I have to go back to school, have to take more classes and do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So that was what I was doing. I went home and I started to... The first thing I did, I applied jobs. So I applied a job in a mental hospital psychiatry hospital where they are very strict. It's very people who are too sick to be in jail were at that hospital. So it was a really tough place to be. And that was an experience in itself, you know, because I didn't know how much about the mind, how it works. So when I started working there, and it was you had to have like clearance to work there. And when I started, but I was big in size, I had good conflict skills, and that was what they needed. But I think mostly when I look back to it, they needed like big guy. So, and it helped when I had from the good feedbacks from the forces, you know, everything. So I got the job, but when I started working there, I thought to myself, but is it possible? How can somebody get so sick? Like people were talking to the wall, you know. I experienced different level of sickness in mental health, and I was like, is this guy kidding me? Is he faking it? But I learned more and more about the mind, you know, from different colleagues and everything. And I got really fascinated about this, I wanted to learn more about this psychology and everything. It was a very fascinating time. And I did a really good job there. And at the same time, I went back to school, private school, to get these classes that I needed to apply to the police academy. So I was really, for the first time, or for a second time in my life, because the army was one point where I felt good. I felt life is a change. For once, now I'm accelerating. Life is good after 20 years in constant being in fight, you know. Life felt really good. And
you felt on top of things. Things are on the rails moving forward.
Moving forward, a good economy. I had money from Kosovo. I had stability. I had good work, and I also worked like a security guard in another hospital. So I did different things. I did the correct things to get to the police academy. That was the plan. And I went to also Sweden with my friends, like to have a party, you know, to enjoy.
Like one weekend kind of thing?
Yeah, one weekend. Yeah, it was over a weekend, a couple of days. And it was a summertime, and there, I'm not the most confident guy at that time with the ladies, but but the shyness was still there, you know.
Yeah.
But it happened that I met this girl at this cafe in Sweden, and we had this look to each other, and she was fucking beautiful, man. She was like, it's almost like a little Disney movie here, you know, like. Like, you know, birds singing, shit like that. But it was really beautiful. It was, I remember this. It was crazy. But it was, and I had the balls to go to her and talk to her. And we started having a good talk. And one thing led to another. And we got together. And at that time, you know, we were writing letters to each other. She was taking perfume on the letters when I received it. So it was nice. It was a good time. And we planned. She was coming to Norway to work with the kids here because she was taking education. And I was going to apply after I was finished with school to the police academy and stuff like that. But as fate will have it, you know. Things happen, you know. So one day I get a call from a brother. He tells me, I remember it very well, that that she was dead, you know. And I went like, don't fuck about, you know. This is not kind of joke, but because me and her brother, we had a good humor, you know. But this was like, I couldn't process it. But listen, don't fuck about this. What are you talking about? She's dead. But short story here was she was Albanian, her father was in the Albanian League in Sweden. I didn't know. I knew her father was a little bit criminal. She told me a little about it, and I met her father and mother and grandmother and everything about this big family there. But I didn't know it was so serious, you know.
To clarify, the Albanian League, is that the Albanian mafia?
Correct.
Okay.
So they were smuggling from Balkan different heroin. And what happened was I didn't know anything. She told me a little bit about her father, but she was also like, she didn't want to have a part of this. Her and her father had a conflict also. And I knew about it, but But I was so in love, you know. I was so, So
well, love blinds us, right?
Love blinds us. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And she was not. I didn't use. At this point, I'm like 23, 24 years old, and I was against drugs. I didn't even drink much alcohol. I was like crazy training, police academy mindset, and so back to it. It turns out she was overdosed. Somebody put an overdose in her, and the circumstances around it, because they had to take autopsy.
Autopsy.
Yeah. Because of the circumstances, because she was not using drugs for real, and but they found out the case was dismissed, you know, but it was taken up because they meant that it was drugs. She used drugs. She never used it. So she was killed, you know. And I later found out it was because of her father. And I can't really not go so much into it, but.
No, it's okay. To the extent you can.
But it was the league, you know, it was a conflict with heroin disappearing, and they went to war with the family in the conflict. So she was murdered, and the autopsy showed that she was pregnant with my child also.
Oh man!
Yeah, yeah. So I remember when I got that message also from the autopsy, I died inside. You know, it was like I saw myself from the outside again, and I just went down. I remember I was outside in this because I had just been jogging, trying to just get the shit out of the system, just jogging like crazy, just trying to process it, because training was something I went back to, because when it was tough, I went training. I didn't want to so much about it. I had to train. So, but I remember I took my hands and I just hit the ground real hard, and I still have the scars on my my knuckles because I was bleeding so much, but I didn't felt it, what I was bleeding and stuff like that. Yeah, so that was a tough blow. That was really, I felt that day I really died inside. But what happened then was I went to Sweden to meet her family and met her father, and I get involved for the first time in big crime because... how can I tell it? It was like it was more like a culture thing in this mob. Like, okay, so this happened to your my daughter. This was your wife, soon to be wife. This, you know, and so we have to do something about this. And I was a soldier. Remember, I was trained, and at that time, like the fuse inside me was lit again. Because that's why I wanted to tell about the background from the bullying from I was a little kid, the racism, the conflict at home. Then somebody just put the fire inside me, the bomb went off.
It rekindled that rage.
Yeah. All that shit come back. And I remember I was talking to, I'm not a kind of a religious guy, but I believe in something, you know, I believe in, I have hope. I would describe it like that.
Some faith.
Yeah, some faith. And I remember I was talking to, call it God. I was yelling at him. I told him different words, you know. I was mad. I was crazy mad. And I hated the world, you know. It totally went off inside me. I thought about this fucking bullying. I thought about this racism. I thought about all the shit I went through. And I was asking, like, why? Why can't I get a fucking break, you know? What is happening? So it made me more, and the background, the training I now had from weapons, the forces, it made me seriously dangerous. And in a dangerous way also, because I really wanted to die also. I didn't want to live without her because I saw no point in continuing because she was my, she was my
football. She was your everything?
Yeah, she was everything. I remember lying in her lap, you know, relaxing, and she was like touching my hair. I felt this calm I never felt before. I felt this ease. It was like I could fall asleep in her lap, and I just a really good sleep. It was so, and now somebody has taken that away from me. The world has robbed me from this. And I was totally mad. And that's what's happened. That was the way in for me to the destructive life. I was, we did some things in Sweden with their family, and I got connected with the family there, with the organization. And I went back to Norway And in Sweden, there were investigations about this and everything. But I went back to Norway and I was really damaged, you know. But I had this hate in me. And I must honestly say, when it comes to the violence, it felt so good. It felt amazing to be able to punish somebody for all the injustice I have felt in my life, you know, and especially about her. So I did some really cruelty shit down there. And when I come back to Norway, I couldn't, the work situation didn't, I started drinking more just to escape from the feelings I didn't want to feel. Because the training was not enough in itself. So I had to drink and drink. And I didn't like alcohol. I didn't like it at all. I just drank just to escape.
It deadened the feelings?
Yeah, yeah, correct, correct. And some of my friends in this bad environment, they had this cocaine and they introduced to me and I started taking cocaine. I didn't care. You know, I wanted to die. So that was the starting point for into the criminal life there. I lost my jobs because I didn't I didn't even call the job and say, I'm sick, I'm not coming. I just gave a fuck, you know.
You just dropped off the grid.
Yeah, I just dropped off the net, you know.
You know, in my long career, I've come across, you know, individuals that they come to the edge of the abyss and they look into the abyss. And it's just that. It's like they have this mindset of oblivion. I don't know if that characterizes yourself, but a lot of what you say are parts of these elements, right? When everything's kind of being stripped, that oblivion, they jump into the abyss and they let it all go and they see what happens from there.
And you know, we I learned about this a little bit later because I have to this day I have a coaching degree, but at that time I didn't. I was really destructive, you know. I was like, I was so angry at the fucking world, you know. I had this enormous rage, but at the same time, the rage felt so good. It was really good, you know. It was like fucking euphoria.
You feed off it, right?
Yeah. It was like I signed a contract with the devil, to say it at least. It was like, I'm going to punish every fucking single person that has ever done me wrong.
Well, folks, that was Michael Ali. As I said at the top of this episode, this is the first of a two-part series. Now, the reason why I wanted to have such a long episode with Michael, because I think understanding who he has become, where he's from, this cannot be talked about in a single hour or a single lecture or a single keynote. It has to have breath and space to understand, to learn about the context in which how these domino effects leads to a person to where he or she is today. And it's not always an easy listen, but sometimes in those stories, we can learn a lot and we can apply those lessons from people's experiences where we don't have to go through literal hell. That we can take their experiences and help ourselves and help those around us. So I hope you'll be able to join me next week for part two. As a call to action, if you could please subscribe, rate, and review this episode and the podcast, you'd be doing me a huge solid. And if you have the chance, please recommend it to friends, to family, to colleagues. And a small effort like that will help me to spread the message of this podcast. Well, until the next time we meet, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.